We have to stop talking now, I apologize.
No, it's fine. Good morning. This is already February 24th, and this is the Education Subcommittee on Education. And we are looking at education issues today. And just all of us should remember, tomorrow there's a lot of activities for the food bank that's happening in the building, so that's why you're late?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just really care about the food bank. That's why we were, Rep Taylor and I were at the food bank meeting this morning. Where were you?
So why was she here on time?
I had to give a speech.
Hold it. Doug.
Madam Chair, to get us started this morning.
Are we out of order?
we're live in front of the people of the state.
Madam Chair, we're continuing with the second day of the three-day overview on the P20 system. A couple things, housekeeping. There is a new version of the presentation on today's OLIS. I got one last night or late afternoon. I think it replaced a few pages. It's basically the same as far as I can tell with some changes. We should be starting on page 23 of that version with this slide. And I believe it's page 23. And there's also some more handouts that I'm sure the speakers will refer to that are in front of you.
Okay, thank you, Doug, and good morning, Dr. Golden, and here, I forgot your name.
Iris.
Yes, it's so nice to see you. Please start before we fall apart again. there he goes again.
Yeah. Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Nancy Golden, the Chief Education Officer. If you remember yesterday, we started going up that seamless pathway with early learning, and then we went to K-12. And we're taking a pause for Higher Ed Coordinating Commission because Ben will be here tomorrow. But the other very important organization is the Oregon Youth Development Council, because they really provide supports for some of our students who need it the most. They are led by Iris Bell, who I think is sensational, and she is going to start.
Good morning, co-chairs Comp and Monroe and members of the committee. My name is Iris Bell, and I'm the director of the Youth Development Council. I have two slides to share with you this morning. The first is one that basically speaks to the establishment of the council and House Bill 4165 and the mandate to support the Oregon Education Investment Board in a manner that supports educational supports and reduces criminal behavior in young folks, but also supports their career and academic development. That slide also speaks to our new investment strategy. We have a new community investment strategy that was mandated again by the legislature for us to put in place. We have put that strategy in place, and it is working very well in the community, I must say. The second slide speaks to the population. Speaks to the population of young people that we are attempting to serve with the investments that we're making in the community. And the council identified two groups of young folks for these funds. The first group of young folks are called Opportunity Youth. And those are youth between the ages of 16 and 24 who have little or no attachment to school or work. And that second group of young people are termed priority youth. Those are young people who are still in school but have the potential to be dropping out or become disconnected from school. Now, some of you, all of you were in the building yesterday. I don't know if you noticed that there were over 100 or so young people in the building yesterday as well. And Representative Huffman and Senator Roblin, you all had the opportunity to actually see those young people yesterday afternoon downstairs. And I think you addressed them, as did Peter Courtney, Senator Courtney, and as did the Governor, Kate Brown. Those are the young people that the Youth Development Council actually supports. Our funds and investments go along with those funds and investments from the local workforce investment boards actually go to help support those young people. They were able to speak later on in the afternoon in a session with respect to the supports they get from the Workforce Investment Board and the Youth Development Council. And they spoke very eloquently about the hardships that they face, about the barriers that they face. There were young babies in that room yesterday, and you saw these young people still attempting to struggle to make good on their efforts to be contributors to our society, and to their efforts to find work, their efforts to educate themselves. Some of them had GEDs, but most of those young people in the room are the young people that we call our opportunity youth. There are 1 in 7 of those young folks in this state, over 66,000 young people. Can you imagine 66,000 of those young people sitting in a room downstairs seeking the supports that they need to be able to be successful? And so we will continue to attempt to support those young people. We don't necessarily have funding in this budget to do that, but we will do it with the funds that we do have. We will use our current service level budget to attempt to fund as many of those programs. There were exemplary programs that were discussed yesterday, and I can't say enough for what community folks are doing on the ground to support those young people. And so we will continue to try and do our best to support them as well. So thank you very much for your attention and time this morning.
Senator Roblin.
And thank you, Iris. And I was one of those people who was exceedingly concerned when we did away with the Commission on Families and Children and Families because of the adolescent group. I think we had already had a good discussion about how we're going to work with preschool and those younger age kids, but adolescents were kind of out there.
That's right.
And this new council has given me hope that we will continue to be funding and working with the systems that were in place throughout our state through the commission and now have a place to call home again. So I really appreciate your efforts. I'm thankful that we are developing it, and I look forward to continuing that work. So thank you for your efforts to keep that together.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I had a group visit me yesterday, and had them all tell their stories, and one young lady was like 16 years old, dropped out.
Senator, you might move your microphone down a little bit.
I'm not used to this. Thank you.
Yes.
I was impressed that she like dropped out, got in this program, and in like 2 months got her GED. So when a student like that that happens, does that count towards our graduation rate? Do GEDs go forward and count as our graduation rates?
No.
That can't be that hard a question. Come on.
Mr. Saxton.
For the record, Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent. So it counts toward our five-year completer rate, and it would count in the 40-40-20 as we have it designated.
Okay, but our graduation rate that we always are rated the worst in the country, does it go to that and help bring that number down?
It does not. Not the one that typically shows up in the newspaper.
But why not?
Typically what we see in the paper is what's called the four-year cohort graduation rate,
okay,
which means that a student enters as a freshman and would graduate 4 years later with a standard diploma. And the idea is that there should be an apples-to-apples comparison in the way that we calculate that across the nation. And so that every state would calculate it the same way so that there's a comparative ability. I will tell you that I don't believe that's the case with the way that our current four-year cohort graduation rate is compared, and that we have taken the strictest letter of the law in Oregon about the way that we do calculate our four-year cohort graduation rate, and the U.S. Department of Education has to accept the methodology that we use to report that, and that other states have been less genuine about the way that they report their graduation rates, and that some of them actually do include GEDs.
Okay.
They're not supposed to, and we are in the midst actually of working with the Chalkboard Project and OEIB to look into that and make sure that we understand it appropriately, and that when we're making our designation on this, that we're doing it the same way as other states are, so that we do get an accurate comparison from state to state. So.
Thank you. One little follow-up.
Any follow-up? Yes.
Yeah, and Phyllis, in this program, the youths that were like here yesterday,
mm-hmm.
Do you guys keep track of how many of those students go on and get their GED? Is that something you follow?
Co-chair Monroe and Representative Thompson, what we have been doing is we've put together a performance measurement piece that goes along with each of the organizations that we fund. And those organizations have set up a process of identifying the young people that they're going to serve and what they're going to be focused on. Some of them focus on attendance. Okay. Some of them focus on GED. Some of them focus on graduation. So we're able to track those that we're funding in terms of what the outcomes are that they are attempting to address.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Huffman and then Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. Number one, Iris, how did the governor's proposed budget treat your budget, YDC budget, compared to the current biennium? And did you show up in the co-chair's framework at all as how they were going to treat the YDC budget?
So in the governor's budget, we're at our current service level going into the 15-17 biennium. So what that would suggest is that we have the same amount of money we had last biennium to support these programs and no additional funds. I will say that we had over 108 applications in our last cycle, and we were able to only fund about 70. So given that, and given now the sort of popularity of our investment strategy in the community, we anticipate a lot more folks seeking to apply, but we will have the same money that we had the last biennium to actually serve those young folks. So we are not identified in the governor's budget.
Okay, follow up?
Yes.
On the funding level, the counties, I got reports from a couple of my counties that they didn't get any money. When we had talked, I think it was 2013, and a House Education Committee, you said there was a flooring on funding.
Right.
How does that work? I know that you had developed in the new procedure some grant funds that mm-hmm. people would have to apply for. How right. did that work? Do we have unhappy counties and juvenile directors out there?
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Representative Huffman. No, not at this time. No one seems to be unhappy. The fact that what we were able to do was to set up a scoring process, and what we went to do is we scored the applications, and then we funded to the extent that our funds would take us. So, for example, a highest score that you could possibly get was 125 points. And we started to score based on 125, 118, until we got to the point where we just simply had no more money to fund. So it was not like those folks who applied from your counties did a bad job or couldn't respond or didn't have young folks that needed to be served. We simply just did not have any more funds to distribute.
Did every county get a base budget?
Every county got a base budget out of the juvenile crime prevention funds.
Okay.
So the juvenile crime prevention funds stayed in place, and every county got those funds, as did all nine tribes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Ms. Bell. Just to review the slide before this about the council versus the division. So is the youth development division separate then from the youth development council? Or is that just where it was moved for a year? Or could you clarify that, please?
I will try.
I won't ask you to do the impossible.
Representative Smith-Warner. The youth development council was established first, and it was established to support the Oregon Education Investment Board. The council moved for a year into the governor's office, and the council still exists. What happened was there was the creation of the Youth Development Division within the Department of Education, and so the division, which is represents me and my staff, actually support the work of the council. Does that help? Does that make it?
That does help. Thank you. So the council still exists in the governor's office?
No. The council is now exists to support the Oregon Education Investment Board.
But the division is you and your staff. That's where the work.
That's where
done.
The work gets done.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Any other follow-up? Great, Iris.
Well, thank you.
You're doing kind of God's miracles, so thank you.
Yes, thank you so much.
Nancy.
So co-chair Comp and co-chair Monroe. Danny Ledesma is going to come up, and we're going to be taking the next part together. But I did want to let you know that I did complete the organizational chart from the student's perspective. Yesterday, I was asked to do that by Senator Roble, and I was very excited to do that because really OEIB's job is to look through the lens of the child. Someone pointed out as I passed it around, you've now put the governor at the bottom of an organizational chart. So I just want to remind people that that was a request.
That's right. And I also thought that they should say governor slash legislature. So we're at the bottom too. So I just, yesterday's it had governor legislature at the top. So.
And just briefly, if you look from the point of a student, what they look at first is who's my teacher, who's my professor at the university, who's my early learning provider. And then they want to know who are the administrators who support them so they can do quality work. And after that, it would look at, if you look at early learning, the hubs or the preschool programs, there'd be districts, there'd be community colleges and universities. And we put regional achievement collaboratives there because we really feel like that's a coordinating group that can work with all of those, like Connected Lane County I talked about yesterday. Then we put the councils, the Early Learning Council, the State Board of Education, the Higher Ed Coordinating Council, and we should have put the Youth Development Council on that, so I will make that change. And then under that is the Chief Education Officer, and then is the Governor Brown and the legislator. So that's the view of the child, and thank you very much for that. It's the view we should be taking as we go into this conversation about what are the suggested investments to really reach the outcomes we want on the Achievement Compact to move students seamlessly along that pathway from birth through college and career. So, Danny?
All right.
And if you can let us know what slide number you're on, Danny. Oh, we're just on to the next page.
Slide 25.
I do the next one.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
You'll remember a few years ago when we had the previous superintendent, you and I would make requests for key information that we needed in order to form a proper budget.
Yes.
And it wouldn't come, and it wouldn't come, and we'd make the request again, and it still wouldn't come. A hint of one of us yesterday, and look what we get. And I'd just like to thank Nancy and her people for being so quick to answer to the needs of this committee.
Well, and thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. And to add to that, I really appreciate Senator Roblin's request because if we can't explain it to the student, why are we doing it? And so this really tells us that, you know, how we can talk to our parents, talk to the students, and say, yeah, we actually do have a plan. So thank you, Co-Chair Monroe, for pointing that out.
Thank you very much.
Co-chairs Kump and Monroe, members of the committee, my name is Danny Ledesma, and for the record, and I'm with the governor's office, I'm the education policy advisor. And so what we'd like to walk you through today is to tell you a little bit about our process as well as some of the thoughts that we had in mind in presenting the governor's requested budget. And so we'll start with this. I believe you've seen this. This is basically our map of the different types of investments with the goal in mind of wanting to think about where we could invest, make investments to make sure that we're achieving outcomes on the Achievement Compact process, and to really think about how we support students move seamlessly through the P20 system. We worked with agencies and with the various commissions and boards associated with education since early spring of 2014 to present concepts and to review those concepts so that we could get the best possible approaches to the budget. Each of the proposals that agencies and their board members presented were vetted through the Oregon's equity lens. We also when we looked at all of the proposals in total, we saw that there were really three main pathways that were that emerged as where folks thought that investment should be made and how we should have investments that support student success. These concepts, as we went through the summer and into the fall, the concepts were refined and really deepened based on best practice models from across the state, many of which were funded through the last biennium strategic investments. And so it is with that that we wanted to talk about a little bit more, where Nancy will talk a little bit more about our approach to budgeting.
Okay, great.
So again, if we think about a P20 system, what I want to talk about first is the first pathway, which is the pathway to kindergarten readiness in third grade. But as you remember, we have these outcomes on the Achievement Compact, and our job is to really say, how do we help drive strategies that are going to get us to those outcomes on the Achievement Compacts? Because we know those are the outcomes students need to move seamlessly along the pathway. So what we did, like Danny said, we convened for a very long time with lots of people to really say what would those key strategies be. And what we knew is that the singular focus needed to be the college and career and this collaborative process to really make a difference on those outcomes. Now, I think what's really critical is that we did look at things through the equity lens, because what we know is we have kids in an opportunity gap, students who, if we bring the right kind of supports to them, the right kind of education, if we start early, if we're proactive, we can pull these kids out of the opportunity gap. And by doing that, we're really supporting all students, because money is really going to go to acceleration as opposed to prevention. So what you'll see with these strategies to get to the outcomes, we really did look at the equity lens. Ultimately, what we thought about is how do we align policies with investments, and how do we integrate these three areas of outcomes in order to really make sure that all our students are career and college ready and we meet the 40-40-20 goal. So as you saw on that chart, and I know you have a copy of that, that what we have is the pathway to kindergarten readiness and third grade reading. It was in the brown on the chart. It's also pathway to high school and post-secondary. Oh, it's green on the chart. And then it's pathway connecting education to career. And above it in brown are some of the major outcomes on the Achievement Compact. So with that, we're going to actually get started and talk a little bit more about these investments.
So our approach to investments, we had four main strategies. The first strategy, if you think about creating a foundation for investment, is that we wanted to make sure that we were adequately funding the base level support funds. And so that was really important. We heard from many stakeholders as well as community groups that really increasing funding for education was top of mind. The second strategy that we looked at is how do we, in addition to supporting the base, how do we support the systems, supporting educators, looking at collective impact, how can we support long-term systems change and systems improvement? And so that was the second thing that we looked at. The third thing was, how can we look at the current expenditures within the state school fund and look at if there's ways that we could incent outcomes within current spending? We wanted to be able to have a conversation about that and to be able to think about, is there something within the funding that we have that could maybe get us to increased outcomes? And then the fourth strategy was looking at how can we strategically invest in strategies that would really drive towards increased outcomes on the Achievement Compact, really drawing from the investments that we made in House Bill 3232 and House Bill 3233 that was $75 million investments from the last biennium. So when we look at the base investments, when we look at that sort of foundational set of investments, the governor's proposed budget recommended a state school fund, the K-12 state school fund number of around $6.9 billion. The co-chair's budget was $7.2 billion. The governor's budget for the Community College Support Fund recommended $500 million. The co-chair's budget recommended $535 million. For the Public University Support Fund, the governor's proposed budget recommended $589 million, and the co-chair's budget recommended $635 million. So the next thing that we want to be able to take you through is looking at our approach from the strategic investments.
I have a question, Danny. Yes, so the figures you just gave us, they're not on the previous slide that said the outcome-based strategies. Did you have those figures available for the committee to refer to so they have what the governor's proposed budget is? In alignment with the co-chair's budget?
Chair Comp, I can get those for you. I don't have them on the slide, but I can get them for
okay,
you.
Okay, because I was wondering if I had missed them or something. So thank you. Yes, I did see Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Comp. I just wondering for the 40-40-20, where are we now? So what is the marginal gain we need to get? So I just wonder if you knew that off the top of your head. I have a feeling you do.
Co-chair Conference Taylor, thank you for the confidence. I don't know where we are right now, but I think we can get you that information. I think that the idea was strategically what the OEIB did and what sort of agencies have been doing is looking at what are the gains that could be made over the biennium, mm-hmm. as opposed to 2025, given that the life of the investments that the legislature would approve would be over the biennium. Mm-hmm. So when we look at on this right here, when you look at the black bars above there, mm-hmm. that show an increase in the outcomes, it's really over a 2-year, over the horizon of a biennium. But we can get you information about it.
Follow up?
Please.
So I'm just, so 40%, how many people now graduate from college?
40.
So we don't, okay. All right. Okay, thanks. Sorry.
Representative Comp, we do have that data. We'll just, and Representative Taylor, we can bring that tomorrow for you.
Mm-hmm. And we are having, this is our first preview of all this information, so I know that we're going to go down into the weeds later on.
Right. Right. Thank you.
Well, the flowers, not the weeds.
So,
go ahead, Danny. Thank you.
Thanks. So what we've prepared for you is that we wanted to do a comparison of the strategies that were proposed in the for you to consider in the governor's budget compared to the strategic investments that were made in 2013-15. So we have a document that we provided for you today that is titled Outcome-Based Strategies to Meet 40-40-20. And so what I thought I could do is just understanding that we'll have more time to as the session goes on to go in depth with these, I would give you just a quick overview to show you sort of how they're framed, and if you had any questions, we can go from there. So in 2013, the legislature passed House Bill 3232, which was focused on literacy, post-secondary aspirations, and connecting to the world of work. And on the left hand of your document, we have outlined in larger buckets the amounts of funding and then the strategies underneath each of those. We heard feedback from many communities from the process as well as some of the early outcomes that there were some of the investments that were showing real promise, that there were some, and that there was also a desire to think about the process to allocate and to really think about how we could propose strategies that were the entire state could benefit and to really think about a scale-up strategy. So the age 3 to grade 3 that you'll hear more about today really looked at the early reading and looked at those strategies and really proposes to scale them up in a strategy that would benefit the entire state, that would be less of a competitive grant program and more of a statewide program. In post-secondary aspirations, through Aspire, mentoring, exam fees, we really heard that, again, that these were, that there were promising practices that were in each of these and that we should look at how we could achieve some of those same outcomes from within current funding. And so we propose three state school funding formula changes for your consideration, and have been having really good conversations with stakeholders and community members alike about the proposed, about how we could look within current practice as well as what was being incentivized through funding. Also, in connecting to the world of work, we heard that for some of the STEM strategies that they were really promising and that we should continue to support that work, particularly the work of the STEM hubs. But we also heard throughout the state many people wanting to hear more about how we could reinvest in career technical education, and that there needed to be a balance between both STEM and CTE, and that we should really work together to show the alignment that there is both in practice and theory, and also to invest in there. And so there's a significant increase in both STEM and CTE between what was proposed last year and what was proposed this year. So if you turn over the next ones, there we'll all go into these equity investments more in depth in a few slides, but as we thought more and more about students who are in the opportunity gap, many of our agencies and commissions proposed strategies that they thought with a relatively small investment could really help to close the achievement gap for low-income students, for students of color, students who are really struggling. The other thing that is proposed, where we propose a significant increase, is looking at seamless transitions. Many of you may have heard of the Eastern Promise program. So it's through Eastern Promise, as well as looking at other strategies and accelerated learning, that we could really think about how to continue to scale these up statewide, that we propose a significant increase in investments as well.
Sure.
I thought I'd pause for
thank
questions.
You. Horner. Thank you. I'm sorry.
So, thank you. This is, we talked a little bit yesterday about the $75 million investment and the returns on that. So, and this, I think, is a version of that. Do you or does the department have specifics on, you know, do we have specifics on, yes, we use, you know, adding that $1.4 million to Aspire, we have demonstrable results that worked, and so indeed that's why we're going to shift to this. Or on the Eastern Promise, yes, look at worked, or and that's why we want to replicate it and whatever. Do you have some of those details as well to kind of, you know, and partially because this is the way you're positing that, well, it worked on this, so now this is what we're looking at for the next biennium. So is that information available? Or
Chair Comp, Representative Smith-Warner, that information is available, with the one caveat is that there were some of the grants that were that were allocated later in the process. So the department has information in as much as the reporting periods are aligned, so they can get that for you, and I suspect they'll be presenting for that.
Thank you.
Yes. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Vice Chair Comp. So I'll just piggyback on what my colleague here was saying regarding, let's take the example of Aspire. So $1.4 million, of course, I think that's a lot of money. But when you look at, you know, what are there, 196 school districts or something, can you please explain how this will actually get to the school districts, where here it seems like a considerable amount of money, but how does it work with the funding formula? And I'm concerned that by the time it gets to individual school districts, it may be $1.50 or maybe $100 for one school and $1.50 for another, depending on their size. So I was just wondering how this, with the formula, these don't get watered down to being such small amounts. So
Chair Comp, Representative Taylor, I wanted to talk, if you don't mind, if we can talk about the student mentoring. I can give you more of a more concrete example. In the student mentoring grants were competitively allocated. Not every school district or student was able to get them, but we've seen lots of really good research as well as results from those programs. And so what we attempted to do with thinking about the conversation about the state school funding formula change for ninth grade on track was to think about how we could provide additional weight for students additional students who were able to meet the benchmarks of attendance as well as credits. And then because the districts would get that additional weight, they would have funding for a mentoring program, but it would really be up to the districts to sort of figure out if it was a mentoring program, if it was, you know, something else. And so it was taking really the concept of mentoring and trying to provide funding through the state school fund that every district could access with a little bit more of a sort of like a tight, loose framework, if you will. So does that make sense?
Did you have a follow-up? Just a minute. Senator Thompson?
Yes, thank you. Little question. So the governor's budget came in, and it included a lot of good things. But you left, what I'm hearing out there is you left 4th grade through 12th underfunded, basically not even at current service level. Can you explain what you guys were thinking when you did that? You probably knew that wouldn't get through this legislature, and so it looks like the co-chair's budget has cut these proposals. So I'm thinking, why don't we do the governor's saying, and then we give schools another $500 million, maybe make it $8 billion, and everybody will be happy. So can you give me the thought process of why you left 4th through 12th underfunded?
Sure. Okay. Chair Kump, Senator Thompson, thank you for your question. I think our approach was is that we wanted to focus early on age 3 to grade 3, and later today you'll hear more specifics about that particular agenda. I think that given the amount of resources that were available, I think we were trying to create a budget that really spoke to the priority of students between birth to age 3, just given that we knew how important that was. And then we tried to propose a state school funding number that we thought was respectable, understanding that it would probably continue to grow. So I think, you know, the approach was is that we wanted to put funding where we thought it was most important. The majority of funding that we proposed goes into the K-12 state school fund, and then we wanted to show other options for investments as well. So,
yes, sir.
So I'm not so sure that's a great strategy, because the co-chairs immediately cut these things down to nothing, and now we're going to be fighting for these things the rest of the session. So might have reversed on you, so hope not.
Representative Senator Thompson, what happens is, I appreciate your question, and the reality is we have to start somewhere, and the governor's budget, with the help of particularly the people in this room, but in the past 4 years, we're not just allocating funds to the district. We have initiatives that we have committed that we're going to fund. And it is this team of people and the OEIB board who some of us really, and we're all different, we have all different views on what OEIB should do. And Senator Monroe spoke of our previous top educator in that field, and he had a different perspective. And now we're looking at, and what we've asked for is these breakdowns, and so that we as a committee and as a legislature can say we really believe in that early childhood investment. That money normally would have flowed out to all the school districts, but we wanted to put an emphasis on early childhood. So that's kind of how we got there, and because we did pass the legislation for OEIB, and $8 billion would be awesome.
It's not that hard.
Well, thank you, but you're a farmer, and you know how to stretch a dime.
I think this committee should push for that.
Okay. We take your thoughts into consultation. Doug will write it down. And Rep. Huffman had a question.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. And please, don't everybody come and see me and try to console me about this comment, because we've all talked about it before. I have a particular dislike for competitive grants, and I'm sorry, Danny, you mentioned competitive grants a couple of times. I hate it, and I hate the direction we're headed. A lot of different things I deal with in legislative budgeting has headed toward competitive grants. It sets up winners and losers, and I hate them. So just wanted to get that on the record. Most of you have heard me say that in the privacy of my office, but I just wanted to share that openly.
Thank you, Representative Huffman. I'm sorry you haven't gotten a grant yet. I think your district has done fairly well with the competitive grants.
Well, and some do, but some don't. So it sets up mm-hmm. winners and losers, and largely small rural counties don't have right. the support staff to have a person, no matter how simple the grant process is. They just don't have the capacity to be able to do it. And a lot of times they're competing with more sophisticated entities or counties or school districts that have the staff to be able to put together a more elaborate application. And I don't like it. It's just not fair.
Well, thank you for your comments. And I'm actually going to step out onto this ledge. And
with me or?
Not with you. The reality is, I believe, well, I'll just use myself an example. I should not be sitting here in this room. I should not be a legislator. I should not have gotten a diploma from college. And yet, because there are people out there that say you can do it, and there's people out there, and I lived in a very small community that said, there's ways we can support you. And grant writing is the same thing. There are people, whether it's at the department or other agencies, I know that it's maybe hard to reach out and say, I don't have a clue, help me. But some of us that have taken that step have found a tremendous amount of help available when we ask for it. So that's my view. I see the glasses half full, not half empty. So thank you.
Continue on.
Please, let's get us out of this hornet's nest.
I think I'll try to get us moving quickly so that you can hear more about the H3 to grade 3 proposal, which I think, just to segue off of what you've been discussing, I think that under Rob and Sarah's leadership at the department, they've learned a tremendous amount from the last grant process. And I think that they understand that we have more and have really great ideas around having more tools in our tool belt. So not everything is proposed as a grant or a competitive process, but we've thought about like different ways to scale things up. So so really quickly, you've heard us talk about the equity lens and about sort of how equity and opportunity are reflected in the budget. So we wanted just to remind you that this is the equity lens, and you have the statement here. As Nancy mentioned, as part of the budget process, all of the concepts were sort of taken through this critical inquiry process. We were thinking about sort of what were the impacts, who is served by different investments, different allocation processes, who might not get served by different investments or different allocation processes, and how can we really ensure that all students are poised to succeed. And so we use this equity lens. I think that Ben, Nancy, Rob, Megan have all shown tremendous amounts of leadership in thinking about how their work can really make sure that they're reaching all students. And they all show a real desire and belief that the opportunity gap represents our state's really single greatest untapped source of opportunity and creativity. Closing the gap is not only sort of the right thing to do, but it really can show promise for our state moving forward. The equity lens, as you know, was created by OEIB to guide decision making. We've been working on its practical application over the past year. We use the lens to vet projects, but we also use the lens to develop and to really think about a few investments that are focused on closing the opportunity gap. So you have a document that says targeted investments to close the opportunity gap. I'll go through these really quickly. The first is to increase diversity and leadership in community collaborations. As you know, we've really tried to focus on the collective impact model and thinking about how communities together with institutions can work together to achieve common goals. And so one of the things that this investment would do is to think about how to better integrate communities of color, not only in terms of participation, but as well as leadership, into the early learning hubs, the STEM hubs, and the regional achievement collaboratives, so that the whole community is really represented in this work. We also proposed an expansion for free and reduced lunch in the amount of $3 million. This would allow for students who qualify for reduced lunch to receive free lunch, given that the difference between for a family is really negligible and can have a big impact. We also propose, I'm sorry, the senator's not here, we also propose funding for high school equivalency work. One portion of that funding would be for coordination. Another portion of the funding would be for thinking about how we can work with providers of instruction support so that more students, more folks are successfully completing the GED and getting the GED, and then also a portion of that would also be costs for to defray the cost of the actual test. We also propose a significant increase in the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. You'll hear more about that from Ben Cannon tomorrow. Attendance, as you know, has been a very big issue for our whole state. As working through the government-to-government relationship in the education cluster, our Oregon's tribes have identified attendance as the top issue that they'd like to work on in terms of education. And so we've proposed a $1.5 million investment on an attendance pilot program for the tribes. And then the
sure. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Could you give me some details on that?
Sure.
What does that look like? How will that money be spent? What are the goals and the outcomes we're attempting to achieve, and how are we going to measure those?
Sure. So depending on which, so the idea is that the pilot would be really in partnership with the tribes. Mm-hmm. The idea would be is that the tribes would choose which age of attendance that they would choose. We heard from many of the tribes that really attendance at kindergarten and preschool was the priority, but we also heard from other tribes that it was the sixth and ninth grade attendance marker. So the outcome would be increased in attendance, as well as some connection to student outcomes around reading or math. But the partnership, we would work in partnership with the tribes for them to develop what is the key issue that's impacting attendance for their tribe, and then the funding would be used to pilot strategies to mitigate that attendance issue.
Thank you.
Representative Huffman.
Please, Madam Chair.
Yes,
I'll
ma'am.
Behave.
Yes, sir.
Just kind of curious, you said it's for a pilot, so is it targeted at one of the tribes, or are all the tribes going to be a part of the pilot program? How's it going to work?
The pilot would be for all of the tribes.
Okay.
So then the last one is expanding youth employment opportunities. We're proposing $15 million to provide work opportunities for Oregonians, particularly young students. This would be not only sort of subsidy for the work opportunity, but also work with organizations that would help prepare students getting work ready. All right.
Okay, so now we've given you some of the background on how we got there, and we're going to start looking at the first half.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Sorry, Warner.
I saw that look in your eyes.
So the Community Leverage Fund?
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Apologize.
You want to skip it over?
Thank you. So the Community Leverage Fund is a $25 million investment that would really support innovation and on-the-ground projects for communities that would be delivered through either the early learning hubs, the STEM hubs, the LWIBs, all of the collective impact that's happening in the work. And so it would be an opportunity for communities to identify what particular outcomes outcome that they want to work on, and then it would be funding to support that work.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Comp. Can you just explain that in a little more detail? So the money will flow to all 16 of the hubs, and then they'll be directed to do, just more specifically, what, how will that money be used, please?
So I believe that Chair Comp, Representative Taylor, the funding would be allocated through the Regional Solutions Center, and so it would be basically a pool of funding that'd be available, and communities would identify sort of which hub or which sort of particular project they would want to work on, and then it would be allocated through the Innovation Center in that way. So it doesn't come with a specific allocated to just early learning hubs or just to STEM hubs. Communities would decide what would be their priority, and then the resources would be available in that way.
Follow up, please.
I'm just curious. So does that mean they would have to apply for it, or who's deciding? Who is the deciding body when you say community? Who's deciding where the money would go? Because obviously a lot of people would love to have that resource. So.
That's right. So they would apply. It would be through an application process, and then the Regional Innovation Center would basically develop a process for, you know, how they would be awarded. So I think what they would typically do is try to get a mix of community members, you know, statewide, to sort of develop like what the priorities are, and then people would respond to that.
Madam Chair, if I can do a short follow-up on that as well. So, and would the goal be to that the guidelines would be in supporting one of the priority, like the kindergarten readiness, third grade reading, ninth grade success? Is that the priorities that these would try to achieve?
That is correct, with an probably with an expansion as well as looking at workforce goals, health goals as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And if I just want to remind you, Danny's doing a great job, but her emphasis is the governor's budget, and Nancy's, I think, is the OEIB budget. So we just need to keep balance and know.
To save our hard questions for Nancy.
Just remember which agency or which department these numbers are coming from. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Danny. Great job.
So I'm going to continue talking about the pathway to kindergarten readiness and third grade reading. And I did want to say one of the roles I see as the chief education officer is traveling across the state, convening people, and really listening the people. I've been doing that since I've been in this position, which is a year from August. And Representative Huffman, I want to tell you, we heard loud and clear about what you said about grants. And so what you will see in this budget is much more of a focus on some scale-up strategies that go out across the system. I'm not saying there aren't grants, but they're significantly less than there was before, based on the feedback we got from the field and knowing that grants incubated some good things. Now every child in every school district deserves that. And I'm saying that now because the pathway to third grade reading, the pathway to kindergarten readiness and third grade reading is one such investment that we're suggesting as scale up, meaning everyone in the state would get it. I think the other thing that really
Nancy, I'm sorry to break up your sentence, but Senator Roblin.
Yeah. I just wanted to say to Representative Huffman and Elsa to you, and thank you, Madam Chair. I agree. I don't like competitive grants so much. I like competitive grants in the formation of getting the best practices.
Ideas, yeah.
So it works there. And on Aspire, which I have been engaged with for a long time, if a community and a school is not ready for it, it doesn't work well to spend money on it because it is probably not going to work. And they have developed really key indicators that say whether a school is ready. And our high school, we thought we were ready, and they came in and said, sorry, not yet. The next year when we actually got the Aspire grant, we understood why we weren't ready because we did the things that they had recommended in between. We got the community support, the people who could be volunteers, and all those other kind of stuff. So we were ready the next time, and I think that process is a really good one. It's not that you aren't going to get it. It's the fact that you got to be ready to be able to use it effectively, or you don't spend the money well. And so I think there's a difference, and I just wanted to make that with respect to some of them. And I think there are reasons to do both. At the end of the day, I'm happy to hear about this one because we have done studies. We know what works better than other things, and now I think we're ready to expand it. So I just wanted to say I agree and respectfully disagree about how you go about doing it. So,
thanks. You want to follow up?
No, I think we're in agreement.
And then we're going to have Dr. Golden continue.
Some of those I wouldn't particularly consider competitive type grant things, so I think we're on the same page.
Okay. I doubt that, but Nancy, please continue.
No, and I appreciate the conversation because it was a big conversation out in the field when we moved around. The second thing, which is core to the OEIB, is the function of convening people. So we did have a few grants around early reading. We gained information from that, and then we brought together people from across the state with expertise in this area, particularly people who reflect the faces of the children, and that's where the strategy came from. And it does involve starting at birth, because we know from the moment a child is born, kids are learning, and what they learn at birth really impacts this kindergarten readiness. So we know that we need to think about healthy babies, stable and attached families, and high quality early learning. And then what we also know is that if we start that early, we truly can start removing these gaps. And it's all about every child moving forward as opposed to the gap. So Rob and Megan are going to talk more about that. But I do want to point out what the actual outcomes are, because we've been talking about outcomes on a seamless pathway. So they are stable and attached families, ready for kindergarten and third grade reading. Then I wanted to talk just a little bit more about really looking at looking at these and how we think about that. And I really mentioned it yesterday. So it matters from birth to third grade reading proficiency. But we've got the strategy called age 3 to grade 3 because that we know that's when most students, little kids, I should say, get into preschool. We know that's when kids start increasing their vocabulary, all of the things I talked about yesterday. And we know that the success there really leverages success all along the pathway. I talked yesterday about third grade reading really being one of the single greatest predictors of student success. I talked about it by how many students dropped out, and I couldn't sleep all night about that because it's all about how many kids graduate. So I told you four times as many kids drop out if they're not reading proficiently. But I also want to tell you about what our eyes really on, what our target. So what we know, if you read proficiently and a little bit above in third grade, you're twice as likely to graduate from high school, and you're three times as likely to go to college. So we want high school graduates, and we want college-going students, so that's the target that we're really, really thinking about. So this strategy, which people get in detail about, is really about investing early, hitting that key gateway, and then knowing things are going to be much easier all along the pathway. So with that, I'm going to ask Rob and Megan to come up so they can really get in detail about the pathway to kindergarten readiness and third grade
reading. And Nancy, we have one question from Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly, I think we all agree on the value of third grade reading, and that is a significant mile marker. Thinking back to a few years ago when we had a conversation regarding our son at fifth grade, there was a great deal of conversation, and I didn't access the data at this point, but I heard at multiple levels from his special ed team that fifth grade was also a very critical point. I'm not just talking about the benchmark tests of third, fifth, and eighth, but that was a critical point as far as recovering those reading skills. Is that just something that was anecdotally say that word
anecdotal.
For me, I can't say it now.
Anecdotally.
Is that something that was just laid on me, or is that is there some research that backs that up? The reason I ask the question is certainly I would love to have no problem, and I would love, if we do have a problem, to have it solved by third grade. But I also want to know what that other latitude is and that other benchmark, if there is one.
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Springer. Thanks for the question. I was a reading teacher, so I love this question. What we know is that in the beginning up to age three, the emphasis is really mostly on the coding, learning the sounds, doing your blending, learning the words. But comprehension is one of what we really look at in age up to grade three. And then what we know from three to fifth grade, there's many kids actually who might be really skilled at comprehending. When they hear stories, they love to talk and stuff like that. So what you really want to do is the way you instruct is in such a way that kids can really use their strengths, and you continue to work on still the decoding and stuff. So long story short, I mean, yes, fifth grade is another key point, but the idea is to make sure they are there at third grade. But if not, the earlier the better. So third to fifth is the next great point to really look at and to start building the strengths of the students. You know, they talk about these big five, which comprehension is one. And what we know is some kids decode well and know the sounds and the words but can't comprehend, and other kids really, you tell a story to a child and they can repeat it to you, but they can't read the story. So between three and five, those come together, and you start seeing, when I was in the school district, there were kids who weren't on benchmark at third grade, but by fifth grade, with the right kind of support, they got there. So it's a critical benchmark.
Thank you.
Target.
Okay. Thank you. Megan, is it now, Nancy, is Rob coming up, or is you
yes.
making?
Yes. Oh, so he's saying, well, you need to move, Nancy.
Senator Roebling.
I just want to make a comment to Representative Springer and whatever I can do. There are some of us who didn't become competent readers until middle school, and we worked at it very hard, and there was some research that indicated that some of us dyslexic have a brain chemistry change in adolescence, which helps fill in the blanks that we didn't have before. Don't know a whole lot of that research. I just know that for me, my parents had to suffer until middle school before I became a reader. So it's an interesting deal depending on the individual. Our goal, I hope, is that we're every time, whenever we can, we get them to be competent readers along that scale. And I it's a difficult one on an individual scale, but from the bigger group, it's pretty clear that there are all these benchmarks. So anything I could ever do to help, let me know.
And Megan and Rob, we have about 15 minutes, so
yes.
Because many of us have to be someplace else at 10, so.
Thank you.
Yeah, members, if we let them give their presentation and then ask questions, or if we have to wait till tomorrow, whatever, let's do it.
Co-chairs Monroe and Comp, for the record, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. I thought I might start off just by answering a question that was asked earlier by Representative Taylor, if that's okay. And it is the percentages that we have of students right now as far as 40-40-20 and how we are on the pathway. And we're at 30 and 19, so 30% who go on and earn a four-year college degree, 19 who earn an AA or a certificate of some other kind, and then about 39% who either get a diploma or a GED. That's after about 8 years, 8 years after high school. So there's got to be a time in order for students to earn their college degree or their AA or if their GED if they have not.
Mr. Saxon, could you go slower so she has time to write that down?
Sorry. 30, 19, and 39. And when we go to the adult population, it looks different than that because people continue to work on that. And we're at about 35, 30, and 30. There's some corruption in both of those data sets that I gave you. That's the best that we're able to put together right now. All right.
Yeah, and Representative Springer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. What is the growth, the benchmark we started from? What is the growth rate in those numbers?
Right. Co-Chairs Monroe and Comp,
and you thought this was going to be an easy quiz.
Sure. You know, I don't know that I have the data on that for sure. I know that two years ago when I started, we felt like we were at about 28 and 19 when we started, you know, working on this. And so that would indicate about 2% on the college completion part of that. But I don't know that I have the latest data on that.
Thank you.
Yeah. But you'll provide it.
We certainly will.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. Okay, good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe and Comp, members of the committee. Once again, for the record, my name is Megan Irwin. I'm the Acting Early Learning System Director at the Department of Education. And today, and maybe tomorrow too, Deputy Superintendent Saxton and I are going to talk to you about the investments that are in the proposed Pathway to School Readiness and Third Grade Reading. I'll be talking about the specific early childhood investments in the green box. Rob will talk about the proposed investment in early literacy that's in blue and the full-day kindergarten investment that's in orange. So as members of this committee know, the first 8 years of life represent an absolutely critical period in a child's cognitive, social, and emotional development. And there's a significant body of research that tells us that this is true and that when we get it right in early life, we set children on a path for both academic and social success later. So, set children on a path to really turn those 40-40-20 numbers around. And we also know on the early learning side that the quality of a child's early environment and the availability of appropriate interactive experiences is crucial in terms of developing their brain architecture, which is going to develop how well a child is able to think and regulate emotions. Which I think is good news because it means that we have the opportunity to influence the trajectory of children in our state through their environments and their experiences that they're having in the first 8 years of life. And so we've built a budget that really supports strategies that allow us to impact a child's environment and experience in those first 8 years through supports for families, for childcare providers, for preschool providers, and by dramatically changing our state's approach to literacy and language development. And so this pathway to kindergarten readiness and third grade reading, I really think, is not a program budget, it's a systems budget. And that is really important, especially on the early childhood side, because in the division that I run, the bulk of the budget is tied up in funding streams that by statute and rule, both federal and state statute and rule, can really only be spent in one or two pretty limited ways. And so in this budget, we looked for places where we could connect those programmatic anchors. For early childhood, it's the employment-related daycare program and the Oregon pre-kindergarten program, and then build a broader system with the funds that are left around there in a way that's innovative and makes things a little bit more flexible, and then that's better coordinated so that we don't have programs kind of sitting out serving the same clients but never actually connecting or talking to each other. The other point I want to make before I talk about the specific requested strategies here is that in early learning in the 13-15 budget, we were instructed to take existing funding from the former Commission on Children and Families and repurpose it to make it more effective. And so everything that we've done in the last 2 years, we've done within existing funding. We were really intentional in this budget, thinking about the most strategic places where we might propose growing our investments, but we really took the charge to use existing dollars to the best use possible quite seriously as we were doing our work this last biennium. So here's where we start to look at the specific investments in the package. And like I said, I'll speak to the proposed $135 million investment that was in the governor's requested budget. $55 million of that is in the human services budget for employment-related daycare. In the interest of time and also what this committee needs to focus on, I'm not going to speak to that unless asked, just because it's in another committee's budget. So we're going to focus instead on the non-human services parts of this budget. On the early learning side, our investments really focus in three ways: investments in innovation and systems building, investments in program in a way that simultaneously builds the early learning system, and investment in two programs that have noticeable service needs and did not receive additional funds in the 13-15 biennium. So on the systems building side, we've requested an increase above current service level for early learning hubs and for something called the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund. Both of these investments were created in the 2013 legislative session out of former County Commission on Children and Families funds to get started. And we're proposing growing our investment in these two areas. The early learning hubs, like I said, were created in 2013 and are tasked with coordinating early learning services across both geographic and multi-sector boundaries. So they have to work with any sector that touches children before they start school, and they're working across geographies that have never worked together before. There are currently 14 hubs across the state. We're working with two communities who are still working to get there. They just needed more time to get to statewide coverage, and we'll have 16 hubs under contract by the end of this biennium.
And Megan, where are those two hubs or potential hubs located?
One is on the south coast in Coos and Curry County, and the other is in the Columbia River Gorge, the five counties up in that area. They're doing...
I understand it's on the next slide.
Yeah.
The west end of the Columbia River Gorge area is ready to go. Is being held up by Rep. Huffman.
I think they're learning to work together very nicely.
It's our district.
Well, we now know why you're sitting on this committee.
That's right.
So one point I do want to make is the oldest hub is the one that covers Marion and Polk counties, and it's 11 mm-hmm. months old. And yet, despite carrying a very new and very different set of expectations and being really young in their development as organizations, the hubs actually are doing business differently than it's been done in the past in a way that's pretty exciting. And I have a set of examples that I can share, but in the interest of time, I think what I will focus on is that one of the places where I think the hubs have shown a lot of leadership is in doing work to connect early learning programs into the K-12 system. They've done that through the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Grant, which is the next investment that I'll talk about. But I do want to say when it comes to the hubs, we had $4 million in the last biennium to get them started. They've done a significant amount of work with not a very significant amount of funding spread across the state. And we think that in order for them to really fulfill the promise of what they can be, that an additional investment is necessary for both coordination and outcomes-based funding. They have a pretty rigorous list of outcomes and metrics that they're expected to meet. And in order to do that, we think they need some funds to invest in filling service holes in their communities, but also in sparking innovative practices like the investment I'm going to talk about next, which is the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund. So this was also created by House Bill 2013, and it was really created to accelerate partnerships between K-12 and early learning. And so in the summer of 2014, we were able to fund 16 sites across Oregon, impacting 125 elementary schools and 9,000 children. And the funding has to be used for aligning curriculum, instruction, and assessment practices across the early learning and K-3 continuum, creating shared professional development, engaging families as partners in their child's learning and development, that's really key, and supporting successful transitions into kindergarten. And an early look at the outcomes data for this program is extremely promising, especially for something that's been in place for 9 months, when it comes to reducing the risk factors for children who participate. We also are seeing a significant increase in parent knowledge and confidence in supporting their children to be ready to succeed when they start school. And just to give you an example, the Eastern Oregon Hub established a summer transition program. And upon school entry this year, the children who participated in that program outperformed their peers both from the hub's coverage area and on the state and at the state average when it came to letter name recognition. Letter sound recognition, and additionally, this program for children who participated closed the achievement gap between white children and Latino children participating in rural Oregon. The program is serving children in Ontario, Vail, Nyssa, and Baker, who are high poverty. And I can share similar data from all across the state. So we're proposing a $5 million increase in this program, which would expand it a little bit, but honestly just kind of keeps it at current service level since we spent $4 million in just 1 year of the biennium. The next investment that's proposed in this set of proposed strategies is a request for $30 million for what we call mixed delivery preschool. This is an opportunity for the state to expand its preschool program up to be able to serve children up to 200% of the federal poverty level. And it would also let us work with different kinds of providers. Currently, all of our preschool investment goes to the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program, which does a fabulous job following the Head Start model for kids up to 100% of the federal poverty level. This investment, which is being worked on by advocates in the field, including the Head Start Association, would let us start to fund preschool in public schools and in licensed childcare that meets a certain level of quality, and in existing Oregon pre-kindergarten programs. So it starts to add a little bit to the mix in terms of where children can be served, where families can choose to have their children served, and it lets us serve up to a higher poverty threshold.
Just quickly, yeah. Megan, is there not a bill out there for professional development for these teachers, particularly Head Start teachers, that they can now get their bachelor's degree? And
that would be in the preschool bill that will go forward that attaches to this investment. That's part of it. And then we're doing, through federal funds right now, significant work on building out the professional development system in Oregon. I talked a little bit about it yesterday. It was built for child care providers. Through the Race to the Top grant, we've been able to bring in Head Start providers as well, so that everybody has access to what we call the career lattice. And then we're working through scholarship programs and partnerships with community colleges to help folks attain higher levels of education in the field.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
well, I was going to say this might be our last question.
I just want to be really cautious when we start talking about further education in certain categories. It gets kind of scary because, you know, I hear back from a lot of service providers that they have to pay staff $10.80 an hour, and they require a bachelor's degree. That does not equate with me, and so. I think that can be a real slippery slope, so we just need to be cautious when we start talking about stuff like that.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Representative. And Megan, if you want to just
bring some
final thoughts.
Yes. So we're going to skip employment-related daycare. The final chunks to just look at up here are the requested increases for home visiting and for early childhood special education and early intervention. These requests go toward two programs that really didn't see a significant increase in the last biennium. I'm best equipped to talk about home visiting because that's the program that the division that I work for actually runs. But in to the 13-15 biennium, the Healthy Families Oregon program was given the policy mandate to serve beyond first births. Previously, they had only served the first time you had a baby, you could get service. Now they're allowed to serve subsequent births, and actually the second and third child can often be more stressful to parents. And no additional funds came. That's probably an understatement, right? Giggles to the childless woman telling you that. But there was no additional funding that came with that change in the policy mandate. And I've got data on the number of eligible unserved families. If you're interested in it, this request would allow us to get pretty close to serving about half of them. So I'm not. That's where I'll end today. The next slide just shows you where the early learning hubs are. As you're considering an investment for the hubs, I want you to consider both the role of investing in them as organizations and the role of investing in them as coordinators and collaborators who can make any investment in any early childhood program go further. And I'll be back up here with Rob tomorrow to talk about literacy, and I can take additional questions then.
Thank you, Megan. And Superintendent Saxton, you now have the important job of every teacher in this world. What's your closing statement? What's your closure for this lesson? Oh, I always give you the easy questions.
You always give me the easy questions, Chair Comp. My closing question or my closing comments would just be that I'm excited about being back here tomorrow so we can get launched into the literacy program that I had an opportunity to wax on about yesterday. So look forward to that.
Thank you. We appreciate all your work. Nancy, Iris, yes, awesome. We're a long ways from where we were 4 years ago, and it's hard to put it into a tight, neat package because it is, it's very big. So thank you. And with that, Doug, anything?
No.
We're adjourned.